Okay, shall we start? Yeah. Okay, so just finished the Kalama Sutta, Kesa Putya Sutta, and that is the last sutta which I kind of consider to be a sutta which is kind of creating the background, the foundation sutta for understanding how to approach, if you like, the Buddha's teachings. And now I'm going to go in a slightly different direction with the suttas. And now the next thing I want to do is to have a look at the sutta called the Chanki Sutta. It's found in the Majjhima Nikaya number 95. And now what we're doing, instead of looking at background suttas, we're looking at suttas that kind of are an overview of the Buddhist path. So this gives an overview of the entire Buddhist path. It's like a bird's eye view, standing back a little bit and seeing the whole Buddhist path condensed together in a very short, fairly brief space of text. So this sutta and the next one is going to be kind of this kind of bird's eye view, and then once we have done that, then we will get down to the gradual training. That is what it's really about, right? So far we've just been messing around a little bit around the edges, and now we're getting into the more serious stuff. I'm just being naughty. I just like being naughty. I suppose I've been trained by Ajahn Brahm to be a little bit naughty. So Chanki Sutta is this overview of the Buddhist path. And this is how it goes. This is only a small extract of a very long sutta. So again, if you are interested in these suttas, please have a look at it at home or wherever you feel like it. And you can read the whole thing there when you get there. So this is how this little extract goes. But Master Gotama, in what way is there the preservation of truth? How does one preserve truth? We ask Master Gotama about the preservation of truth. And the background here is a long discussion between Chanki and the Buddha. And the Buddha is pointing out some weaknesses in this Bharadvaja in his way of looking at the Brahmanical teachings. So now he's wondering, well, how then do we preserve truth? If we don't go around repeating these Brahmanical teachings, then what are we supposed to do? And this is what the Buddha replies. If a person has faith, Bharadvaja, or confidence, if you like, he preserves truth when he says, my faith is thus. But he does not yet come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, anything else is wrong. Right? So, and this, I think, is very similar to what I was saying before about many things about the Dhamma as well. When for things like rebirth, it's one of those kind of controversial areas in the Dhamma, I suppose, especially perhaps in the West. The idea here, of course, is that we recognize the distinction here between faith. When you only have faith in something, that's what you say. I have confidence that there is rebirth. I think there are good reasons for believing that there is, but I don't actually know. I can't come to a definite conclusion that this is true and everything else is false. Right? So what are some of these reasons for having faith in something like rebirth? And one of the reasons that I like, which I think is really powerful reason for having faith in rebirth, is because the Buddha said so, right? It's a pretty powerful reason. And usually when we talk about reasons for having faith in something, often we talk about anecdotal evidence. Somebody tells you a story from somewhere, oh, this is what happened to me, right? Because of this happened, I have faith in that. I had an out-of-body experience, that's why I believe in an afterlife after this. This is called anecdotal experience because there are stories that we hear, and those stories tell us a certain way of looking at the world, if you like. Now, the Buddha talking about rebirth is just one other story, really. The Buddha tells his life story. He says, this is what happened to me. I recalled my past lives, right? It is, in a way, an anecdotal type of evidence that you have when the Buddha is saying these things. It is a story about his particular life. But it is a particularly strong form of anecdotal evidence because it comes from the Buddha. We know the Buddha said these things. We know that here is this spiritual mind who lived 2,500 years ago, who there's a very good grounds for having a lot of faith in many of the things that he said. He obviously was somebody very special. And when somebody that special tells you without any doubt that he has experienced rebirth, again, it becomes a very powerful source of evidence in my life. And this is the kind of thing that becomes then the source for believing in something or disbelieving in it. And this is what is meant by preserving truth. So if somebody asks me, I will say, yes, I have very strong confidence that there is such a thing as rebirth for many reasons. Not just the Buddha, there are also many other people too who say that there is such a thing. And of course, if they are believable people with a high sense of integrity, it's very hard to dismiss these kind of things, right? But this is the right approach, anyway, to deal with these things. To say things as they are. I have confidence. But you don't yet come to the conclusion. And then the Buddha says, in this way, Bharadvaja, there is the preservation of truth. In this way, he preserves truth. In this way, we describe the preservation of truth. But as yet, there is no discovery of truth. So far, it's faith, but discovery is further down the line. Discovery is here the same as awakening itself, right? When you actually see things for yourself. And then, of course, he asks about this. In what way, Master Gautama, in that way, Master Gautama, there is a preservation of truth. In that way, one preserves the truth. In that way, one recognizes it, we recognize the preservation of truth. But in what way, Master Gautama, is there the discovery of truth? In what way does one discover truth? We ask Master Gautama about the discovery of truth. So this is how discovery comes. You start off with faith, right? And then from faith, you develop it further. And this is what you do. Here, Bharadvaja, a bhikkhu, may be living in dependence on some village or town. Then a householder or a householder's son goes to him and investigates him in regard to three kinds of qualities. In regard to qualities based on greed or desire, in regard to qualities based on anger or ill will, in regard to qualities based on delusion or confusion. Are there in this Venerable One any qualities based on desire, ill will, and confusion, so that with his mind obsessed by those qualities, while not knowing, he might say, I know, or while not seeing, he might say, I see, or he might urge others to act in a way that would lead to the harm or suffering for a long time. Right? So, this is this kind of situation that we all come across in our lives as Buddhists. We want to find out who knows, who has got the goods, right? So, yes, we accept the Buddha, but as always, it's useful to have more than just the Buddha, because we want to see the Buddhist teachings come alive in individuals, ideally, if we can. So here, and what happens here is that you have a certain monk, right? Living independent on some village or town. Living independence means that's where you go on alms round, they support you in various kind of ways. This sometimes still happens in certain Asian countries, that bhikkhus live in this kind of way. Less and less, because these days very often you live in kind of monasteries, but this is more like an independent way of living, it seems. But anyway, whatever it is. Now, once that bhikkhu is there, then the householder or the householder's son, this was the establishment at that time, they go and investigate him in regard to three kinds of qualities. Right? And this is one of those interesting little things when the Buddha talks about how we should deal with establishing faith and confidence in somebody. What should we do? And what the Buddha says, we should investigate that person. Do they actually have, does this person have defilements or not? We look at them and we see, is there any greed or desire? Is there any anger or ill will? Is there any confusion and delusion? We're supposed to investigate these things. And this, I think, is a very important statement, because sometimes people are afraid of investigating, they are afraid of making, maybe I make bad karma if I look for those bad qualities, right? But the point is that the only way that we can ever know whether somebody is worthy of faith and confidence is if they have the right qualities or not. If they haven't got the right qualities, then they are not really worthy of that faith and confidence. And the only way we can do that is to investigate these things for ourselves. It is a very important thing. And what the Buddha is of course saying is that he encourages us to do this. He's saying that not only encouraging us, but he's saying that we can do this. We should trust our own judgment in regard to these things. Sometimes I hear people say, oh, I can't really trust my own judgment. But in the end, your own judgment is going to be the one that you have to trust anyway. Whatever you do, wherever you place your faith, some degree of your own judgment will have to go into that. Maybe you listen to other people, what they say, but who is to decide who you listen to? You have to decide that as well, right? In the end, it comes back to your own judgment, and you have to trust that. So I say, reading suttas like this, we should not be too concerned, we should not be too afraid of having a reasonable judgment about the people in our life that we place faith in. It's not dangerous. In fact, what is much more dangerous is not to have any judgment at all and to believe anything we hear in the world. Very often what we hear is that we hear that this person is an arahant, this person is a stream enter, this person is so and so, this is a bodhisattva over here, this one may be a Buddha over there, right? This is the kind of thing you hear, right, in the world. You hear all these crazy things sometimes. And what you should do in those kind of situations is say, maybe that is true, but I'm going to withhold my judgment until I see things for myself. I want to really see what is going on. Because there are so many rumors going on. There are so many things kind of being whipped up into a frenzy because so many people believe it. Everybody says he's an arahant, so he must be an arahant. Don't fall for that, right? Because what everybody says usually turns out to be wrong. Everybody isn't wise. It's a very small amount of people who are wise in this world. So just because everybody says so doesn't mean very much at all. The fact that everybody says so sometimes, it can have the opposite, quite the opposite meaning. So that is why it is important often to withhold our evaluation and our judgment and see things for ourselves and not be afraid of actually seeing problems, if there are problems, not being afraid of making at least sufficient judgment to say, okay, I'm not sure about this. What I feel, it looks to me that there is some problem here. So you don't necessarily denounce the person and say they are evil or anything like that, but at the very least, you have some doubt about them because you can see things that aren't quite right. And I think this is so important, and it's something that people in the modern Buddhist world often don't do. I was in Thailand last year, it's almost exactly a year ago, and I went to visit a monk who was very famous for his metta meditation. This was in Bangkok. And he told me that, he said, one of the weaknesses, he said, of the Thai people, he's Thai himself, right? So he said that one of the weaknesses of Thai people is that they are a bit cowardly. They're often afraid of, you know, saying, if they see bad things happening, they are afraid of saying so, because they are afraid of making bad karma. Everybody says this is an arahant. If I say something bad about the arahant, I'm going to make bad karma, right? This is what they say. So it becomes like everybody goes around saying that people are arahants. Nobody is kind of willing to call out the big problems, right? So, and this is the elephant, what they call it, the elephant in the corner, that what they call it these days, the elephant in the room. And this becomes very problematic. And the Buddha is very clear that we should trust our own judgment. And he says that it is, if somebody is behaving wrongly, if somebody has bad qualities, it is actually good karma to be aware of that, to be clear about that. Not to denounce them and to be negative and angry, but to be clear about the weaknesses in people around us. It's actually so important. And he says specifically that to speak dispraise of somebody worthy of dispraise is a good thing to do. If you speak praise of somebody worthy of dispraise, it means that you are doing something wrong, because you are promoting somebody who actually is not worthy of praise. They are worthy instead of perhaps not, of, you know, they are, can be dangerous if they're not worthy of praise. They can do all kind of damage and things. Sometimes we see even abuse going on, right? People in a spiritual position, the Catholic Church in the West has been under a lot of fire for all kind of abuse of children, all these kind of things. And it's important to call these things out. If nobody calls them out, nothing is ever going to happen. It's just going to keep on going. And even if it is not that bad, even if it's a little bit less than that, we have to have the courage to speak out if there is a problem. Not be one other sheep which follows along the rest of the sheep, right? And just saying what everybody else is saying, but having the courage of our own convictions. And then that is really the way of promoting growth and promoting health in the Buddhist teachings. Because it is only going to be healthy if there is integrity in the people within the Buddhist teachings, with the teachers, with the monastics, with the lay people. Everybody has to have that integrity. And when you have the integrity, then Buddhism will flourish in the future. So please keep that in mind. I think it's an important thing. And this is what this sutta is all about. That willingness to observe, are there problems, are there not problems? And trust your judgment, right? At least so far. At least to have doubts about it, at the very least. And then we're doing the right thing in the world. Otherwise, we become part of the problem. Don't want to see. No, look in a different direction. And then, you know, that becomes then very problematic. But then, of course, if you do see good qualities, then you can start to place at least some degree of confidence in that teacher, because you know that they are doing the right thing, they are living in the right way. And then, of course, you have to keep your eyes open, you have to keep on investigating, because over time things may change, right? And as you do that, then you will get a more well-rounded view of this person. And of course, yeah, so then, if you don't see any of those, and of course the important point here is that, as he says here at the very end, because of that anger and delusion and greed, he might say, while not knowing, he might say, I know. While not seeing, he might say, I see. Right? And this is often what happens. People can be overcome by these things. That is my Thor, my Nordic compatriot, is making all the noise outside. You're just hearing it. because, you know, often when we are overcome by defilements, we do these kind of crazy things. We say things that are completely wrong, even if we know that that is the case. Or we are just doing it because we... not because we know it is the case, but because we are deluded. We think that we are greater than we actually are. But regardless, all these defilements make us do crazy things like this. And of course, the important point here as well is that he might urge others to act in a way that would lead to their harm and suffering for a long time. Right? If you have a spiritual leader who really is a fraud, or not necessarily fraud, but they are coming slightly from the wrong place, they don't really know what they're talking about, they can do things and say things that are very harmful to other people. And this is what we have seen. We see that around the world sometimes. People who are really, really, really bad and really do things that are incredibly damaging to people. You have this kind of suicide cults, right, that we had in America sometimes, and all of these kind of things. That is really an extreme, but I mean, still, it shows you how far bad these things can go if the person is really deluded and taking others for a ride. And sometimes these people, they can be very charismatic, right? They can be really kind of, people are drawn to them for some strange reason. And often it is the people who are needy, the people who don't have the sense of independence, the people who need support in the world, they're the ones sort of drawn to this, because they haven't got anyone else to look after them. And of course, that is why the kind of the disaster is particularly bad in those particular cases. So by calling things out in time and seeing problems where there are problems, we're actually helping to alleviate these kind of issues. as he investigates him, he comes to know there are no such qualities based on desire ill will and delusion in this venerable one. Right? The bodily behavior and the verbal behavior of this venerable one are not those of one affected by desire, ill will, and confusion. And the Dhamma that this venerable one teaches is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle to be experienced by the wise. This Dhamma cannot easily be taught by one affected by desire, ill will, and confusion. So, you come to investigate him, you see that the Dhamma that they teach matches with their conduct, right? The way they speak is also the way they act. This is one of the qualities of the Buddha in the suttas, yatavadi tattakari, the way he speaks is the way he acts. And this is, the ideal way, the proper way that anyone in a position of spiritual authority should be. What they teach and what they act should actually be congruent. It should match with each other. And that is when you really start to get faith in somebody. Especially when they do teach profound teachings and they act in accordance with that profundity. And that is what you see in the Buddha, and that is what you see in people who are master meditators wherever you find them. So then what happens then is that when he has investigated him and has seen that he is purified from qualities based on desire, ill will, and confusion, then he places faith in him. Filled with faith, he visits him and pays respect to him. Having paid respect to him, he gives ear. When he gives ear, he hears the Dhamma. Having heard the Dhamma, he memorizes it and examines the meaning of the teaching he has memorized. When he examines their meaning, he gains a reflective acceptance of those teachings. When he has gained a reflective acceptance of those teachings, zeal or desire springs up. When desire has sprung up, he applies himself, applies the will. Having applied his will, he scrutinizes. Having scrutinized, he strives. And resolutely striving, he realizes with the body the supreme truth and sees it by penetrating it with wisdom. Right here, in a very short little paragraph, you have from the very beginning of gaining faith in somebody all the way down to attaining the supreme truth. The paramatta satcha is the Pali word used here. And the entire training, from the very beginning to the very end, is found in this little paragraph here. So for that reason, it's quite interesting, right? And one of the things that is interesting here is that a lot of this, the first few factors there, are all about listening to the teachings, placing faith in the person, scrutinizing those, memorizing the teachings, examining them. A lot of it has to do with how we deal with the Dhamma, with the teachings themselves. In a small paragraph like that, very little is actually said about the practice itself, and so much focus is on the actual teaching, the Dhamma. That's very interesting, right? Now, why is that the case? How come so much emphasis on the teaching and so little emphasis on the actual results and the practice of this? So let's have a look at this and see what he is saying here. So first of all, you gain faith, right? Because you see the actions and the verb words actually fit with each other. Then you visit that person, that teacher, in this case the Buddha, or any other teacher that you have. When you visit him, you pay respect and you give ear. You listen to those teachings. You hear the Dhamma, right? And of course, when you hear the Dhamma, either you gain more faith or you gain less faith. If you gain less faith, you leave. We never see you again. You say, Buddhism is not for me. I'm going to find some other religion which suits my purpose. And that, of course, is perfectly fine. But very often, if you are this kind of inquisitive character in the first place, very often you will find the Dhamma being very suitable to you. So you give his ear, right? Then after he gives ear, he hears the Dhamma. Hearing that, he memorizes it. These days, you don't memorize it. You get this little nice little booklet from Bobby. Bobby gives you a booklet, and that's where it all is. You don't have to be so concerned about it. And then once you have the booklet from Bobby, then you examine those teachings, right? By coming to the BGF and thinking about these things and examining them carefully. And as you do that, you gain this reflective acceptance of those teachings. In other words, you think about them. Do they make sense or not? Do they apply to my life? Where do these teachings lead? Do they lead to happiness? Do they lead to suffering? Are they good for myself and for other people? And all of these kind of things. And as you investigate this, you gain this acceptance of the teachings. Yes, I accept these things. And of course, as you do that, that is when you really become a Buddhist, right? Because you're taking on board these teachings in a much deeper sense. And that is over half the paragraph already, just on how to deal with the Dhamma. And it is very fascinating that there is so much emphasis on precisely these things. It means that they are very important, right? If whenever the Buddha emphasizes things in this way, it means that they are really important, all of these aspects. And the sutta that I will be looking at tomorrow morning, after this one is finished, shows exactly the same thing. It starts off with, at the very base of everything else, before anything else happens, is the idea of the Kalyana Mitta, the idea of visiting and seeing the Buddha, seeing the Saparisa, the Aryans, those people who have direct access to these teachings. That is the base for everything else to happen, and then awakening follows as a consequence. Just as what we are seeing here, right? This emphasis on visiting the Aryas, the Noble Ones, and then from that here in the teaching, and then awakening happens, stage by stage, awakening happens as a consequence. So this foundation of listening to the teaching, this is really where it is all at. This is the most important thing. This is actually what enables everything else to happen. And what is interesting about this is that, you know, we often think, yeah, you know, we've got to do all of these practices and all of that. But in a way, everything, all that practices that we do, whether it's meditation, coming here to the BGF or whatever it is, it tends to happen as a matter of course. If you put in place the basic things, which is understanding the Dhamma, which is listening to the Buddha's teachings, having faith in those things, if you put these things into place, everything else tends to happen almost automatically, almost by itself. And this means that one of those really important things in our life is that we continuously take on board the Buddha's teachings, that we inspire ourselves, we try to understand what these teachings are about. And then as we do that, it's almost as if we are. It's not almost as if we are. We are. We are brainwashed, right? Isn't that great? We are brainwashed. Hooray for brainwashing. Wait a minute. Brainwashing is supposed to be really scary, right? Oh, brainwashed. Okay, got to be careful here. But, of course, from a Buddhist point of view, we have to be brainwashed. We have no choice. Why? Because that is what conditioning is all about. You recognize that who we are as people, this is the accumulation of all the conditions that have worked on us for lifetimes, for this life, from our upbringing with our parents, when we went to school, all the people we have met, right? All of that is our conditioning. That is roughly equivalent to, that is the same thing as brainwashing. The person you are now is precisely the product of all of those things that have worked on you for such a long period of time. So, for that reason, it is important that we allow us to be brainwashed in the right way. Right? Get the right washing powder. If you have the wrong washing powder, you don't come out clean on the other end, you come out dirty on the other end. That's the bad brainwashing. Get the good washing powder called the Dhamma. Dhamma written on the pack. Right? Pour it into the machine. Chuck yourself inside. Get a nice big machine because we're quite large. And then you wash around. Actually, just put your brain in there, because only your brain that needs to go in the machine. Get a nice brain wash. Come out bright and sparkling brain afterwards. Put it back in again. Whack, back in again. And then you are in business, right? Brainwashed. So it is a nice idea of way of thinking about conditioning. We need to allow ourselves to be conditioned by the beautiful teachings of the Buddha. If you don't allow yourself to be brainwashed by the teaching of the Buddha, you're going to be brainwashed instead by some rubbish in the world, right? Some ridiculous thing. Go down to the shopping center and shop. Hooray! Shopping! Shop till you drop, right? That is kind of bad brainwashing. What is it? What do they call it? Anyway, retail therapy, right? So that's exactly. That's bad news. Instead, we do Dhamma therapy instead of retail therapy, and then we are on the right track. So it is. Once you start to understand what is going on here, you start to understand the power, the importance of allowing ourselves to be conditioned the right way. Call it brainwashing if you like, because it's an easy word to remember, right? It kind of makes a bit of impact. And once you understand that, you ensure that you always, use the opportunity whenever you can to allow that brainwashing to happen. Listen to Dhamma talks, read a bit of suttas, allow these things to come inside. And as the brainwashing and conditioning happens, the rest happens as a matter of course. You start to be kind. You start to, live a beautiful life. You start to do a bit of meditation practice. You start to think about other people in the right way. And things start to go more smoothly in your life as a consequence. But the root, the basis of it all, is this idea that we have to allow ourselves to be conditioned by these marvelous teachings. If you do that, then it will work out. So are you still sure you want to be a Buddhist? Do you think maybe Buddhism is a bit worrying now, right? Ooh, brainwashed. No? Okay, good. I'm glad you're not think that. So you hadn't really counted on the brainwashing here. I think this is what happened when my parents heard that I was going to become a Buddhist monk. They thought, oh, he's going to be brainwashed. We will never see him again. He will disappear into some monastery, and that will be the end of it. But that was not correct. That was not how it worked out. So this is what this is all about. And you will notice here that some of the important things here are you give ear, right? You listen to the Dhamma, and in some place in the suttas it says that you listen to it as a matter of vital concern, right? Wow, I really got to hear this. It's incredibly important. My life depends on this, right? That's how you listen to it. Let me really listen to this as a matter of vital concern. And then you remember these teachings, you examine their meaning, right? These things are very important things. The idea of reflecting on these teachings. What do they actually mean for me? How do I apply them? And if there's something you don't understand, try to get your mind around these things. Ask some questions. Don't be afraid of asking questions, of course. Well, you're quite good here, so that's no problem. As you do that, these things start to penetrate inside. And it's surprising how long it takes for these teachings really to penetrate. Right? I've been a monk now for 22 years. I've been a Buddhist for even longer than that. And still, I read the Sutta. I still think, wow, suddenly I understand something I never understood before. Or I understand something a little bit more deeply than before. Right? After 22 years as a Buddhist monk. So you may think, oh, I understand this sutta, and you probably do, but sometimes it is just a superficial understanding, and there's a potential there for going much more deeply. And that is what happens when you reflect on these things. It goes deeper inside of you. It becomes almost part of you, until one day you become a stream enter. And when you become a stream enter, the teachings become part of you because you have seen the Dhamma. You know what these teachings are all about. And then it is part of your psychology. You become like Dhamma, right? You become walking Dhamma, walking Tipitaka. Bit square, maybe, but that's basically what's happening, right? The Buddha was basically walking Dhamma. That's what he was. What a wonderful thing that is when that happens. So gradually, you move in that direction because you allow yourself to be conditioned by these teachings. And as you do that, as it says here, you get the reflective acceptance of things. Gradually, gradually, gradually. I know how many people I know, especially in the West, people who have become monks after a while, they started out saying, oh, rebirth, that's bad, that's rubbish. And we all know that there's no such thing as rebirth. And then gradually over time, the brainwashing does its work, right? Going around and around the washing machine. And then after many years, even these people who had very different views in the beginning, they come out and, yeah, actually rebirth makes sense, right? Yeah, I really believe in rebirth. It makes good sense. So before it didn't make any sense, now it makes sense. So what's going on there? And of course, what's going on is conditioning. This is a weird thing about views, because we feel that views are something personal. This is my view. It feels so permanent sometimes, right? This is the way things are. I have seen this for myself. This is my view. And because it is so personal to us, it feels very permanent, just like the sense of self feels permanent. I am who I am. These are my qualities. In the same way, our views feel permanent. But remember, even though it may feel that way, it's not actually the truth. Our views are not permanent. Our views exist because they are conditioned. Your view can change very quickly. Right? And sometimes if you see people who don't believe that, they feel that this view is right, it's kind of, this is the way things are. And a few years down the track, suddenly they are completely different. They have changed 180 degrees in the way they think about things. You can see this in politics. You can see it in religion, right? One year you're a Buddhist. The next day, oh no, I have discarded all that rubbish religion, Buddhism. Now I become a Christian. Much better deal, right? Christianity, much better deal. All you have to do is believe, none of that kind of keeping precepts and meditating stuff. Just believe and that's it. Very, very good deal. It's a good deal if you get the goods. If you don't get the goods, it's a bad deal, right? So this is kind of, we have to look at these things carefully here. But it's all conditioning. And once you understand that it's all conditioning, you don't take your views so seriously anymore. You stand back. You allow things to be a little bit. Okay, this is my view. Let's see how it develops. You don't reject it, but you say, okay, let's see how it develops into the future. And this, I think, is a very good attitude to have, not to take these things too seriously. Anyway, you get the reflective acceptance, and this is the beginning here. Then, when you get the reflective acceptance, what happens? Zeal springs up. Zeal, chanda in Pali, it means like desire, a wholesome kind of desire. You want to act on those teachings, right? If you do get some confidence in Buddhism, you want to act accordingly. You want to keep the precepts. You want to purify yourself. You want to do some meditation. You want to become a monk, right? You want to become a nun, perhaps. A nun and a monk. Yay! And then you can really practice these teachings fully. We have a few candidates from Malaysia right now at our monastery in Perth. We have, you know Lei Han, right, everyone? Lei Han, yeah, he's going to become a monk, a novice monk, on May the 8th, which is a Monday. That's when he's kind of an alumni of the BGF, right? This is where he came from originally. And now he's becoming a monk at our monastery. His wife, is she ex-wife or wife? I'm not sure if they must still be wife, I think, wife and husband. I'm not sure. Is that a good idea when you are to be married when you are monastics? Anyway, so she is a nun at the Masara Monastery. She is Venerable Jyotika now, right? And then he is now becoming, I think, Venerable Appamado or something at our monastery. It's really beautiful when these things happen. And there's another young man. He's only in his 20s. He's from Penang. CC, we call him. He's very, very, very nice. You know CC? Yeah? Very nice young man from Penang. Very kind of positive. And he also is kind of moving towards becoming a monastic. So this is what happens when you get brainwashed, right? You end up becoming a monastic. So be careful. If you don't want to become monastic, I give you the chance to leave now. You want to leave? This is the opportunity to leave. Otherwise, you never know what's going to happen. Anyway, it's nice to see that. One of the things I like about monastic life is that we have so many people from different places around the world coming together. It's a very multinational, a very multicultural community. And what a wonderful thing that is when you can live together like that with many people from many different backgrounds. It's really, really nice, actually. One of the things I really value about the monastic life. And our Buddhist society is also very much the same. It is a very, very, very multicultural Buddhist society that we have in Perth. So desire rises up, zeal springs up, chanda, this positive kind of desire, the wanting to do things in the right way, right? This is what happens. And because that chanda springs up, then you start applying yourself. It says he applies the will. I haven't been able to check the Pali because I have a laptop with me, but my laptop is striking right now. I can't make it work, so I wasn't able to check the Pali before I came in here. I always like to check the Pali because it's nice to see what the words actually are here. So he applies the will and then he scrutinizes. So what is going on here? I think scrutinize, the Pali word is tuleti. It quite literally means to measure. And so he is measuring. So when the desire arises, then you apply yourself, apply the will, you start practicing. Then you need to measure, right? You need to compare your progress and compare that with the Dhamma. That's what the Dhamma is all about, is to give you a map of the progress. Am I making progress in the right way? This is what I think tuleti means here. You're measuring things. You are comparing things. Comparing the actual teaching with your own personal experience. Your personal experience should match up with the teachings. And when there is a match up, you know that you are on the right track. Yeah, and that is, of course, when even more faith and confidence arises, when you see that these teachings actually are working for you. So you scrutinize, you keep on scrutinizing as you move along the path, always ensuring that you're on the right track, heading in the right direction. And when you do that, the more you scrutinize, the more you measure, the more you see that you're on the right track, then you strive, right? And striving here does not mean that you are putting forth an enormous amount of effort and really forcing yourself. It is often a natural energy that comes from the fact that you see that things are working, right? You just want to strive. You want to meditate. You want to do walking meditation. You want to be kind because you know it works. You have seen it for yourself. You don't have to force yourself to be kind anymore. It starts to happen almost automatically because you have been conditioned in that direction. And eventually, as you keep on striving, as you keep on applying that energy over a long period of time, maybe probably many years, sometimes lifetimes, be careful about the lifetime one. Better to get it out of the way this life, otherwise you may be in trouble. But anyway, you keep on practicing, then one day what happens is that you make that breakthrough, right? As it says here, you realize with the body the supreme truth and you see it by penetrating it with wisdom. And at that point you have discovered the truth. And that discovery of the truth is when you become a stream enter. When you become a stream enter, you are heading for awakening. There is no turning back. If you don't like what you see, tough luck. You are No, you're going to like what you see. That's the whole point, right? You're heading towards the highest happiness possible as a human being. So this is what you're going towards there. So it's strange here, the translation. You realize the supreme truth with the body. Right? Isn't that a strange translation? How can you realize the supreme truth with the body? This body can't realize anything at all. All it can realize is pain when I sit in meditation. That's pretty much all I can realize with this body. Certainly can't realize any supreme truth. And this shows you sometimes the importance of getting the translation right in these particular things. It is not the body that realizes the supreme truth. What it actually means is that you have a direct experience of the supreme truth. Right? So you directly experience the supreme truth, or you directly realize the supreme truth. That is what this really means. And this is something you see in the suttas. The word is kaya, and the reason why it is translated as with the body is because kaya often has the meaning of body as well. But in the suttas, when it's found in this way, kayena, it actually means a direct and immediate experience of that truth. That is actually what it was referring to. So you can see how distorted it can be if you don't translate it with care. If we just follow a standard pattern, kaya always means body. then we get these kind of distortions in the teachings into English, and it's very hard to really make any sense of it, because I certainly cannot imagine what it might mean to realize the supreme truth with the body. Doesn't make any sense. Other places it says realizes the immaterial attainments with the body. How can you realize immaterial attainments with the body? That's also completely non-logical. If it is immaterial, it is precisely the fact that the body's got nothing to do with it. Right? Again, it is very strange. And you can see how translation actually is important for our ability to understand these things. So, and you see that truth by seeing it with wisdom. And this is when you become a stream enterer, I think, in this particular case, is what this is referring to. And then there is no turning back. You're heading towards the highest happiness. You have no choice but to move towards greater and greater happiness until eventually all suffering is put behind. All that is left is happiness. In this way, Bharadvaja, there is the discovery of truth. In this way, one discovers the truth. In this way, we describe the discovery of truth. There you are, the Chanki Sutta, and all about giving you an overview of what this path is about, and in particular emphasizing the importance of the beginning of the path, getting the Dhamma right, finding the Saparisas, the superior people who can teach you the real Dhamma, and once you get that right, everything else tends to happen as a matter of course. You get pulled along in this powerful stream of the Dhamma, right? The Dhamma is this incredibly powerful thing. Once you start to realize it, you just get carried along. One of the metaphors used by the Buddha, he talks about the Dhamma Chakka, the wheel of the Dhamma in the world. And the wheel of the Dhamma, he sets it rolling, right? Sets the wheel of the Dhamma rolling. And when the wheel is set rolling, it keeps on rolling and rolling and rolling until eventually the momentum of that wheel runs out. And when the momentum runs out, then of course the wheel falls over. But the point is, the wheel of the Dhamma, what it shows you is how the Dhamma moves on from one generation to the next one. When the next generation hears it from the previous one, they think, yeah, wow, that is so beautiful and so powerful. And they take it on. And it moves on like that, down the line. And it cannot really be stopped. It can't be stopped. Because whenever people hear this thing, they feel compelled to act on these beautiful teachings. And when they act on the beautiful teachings, they eventually have the same insight. Pass it on to the next generation, and it keeps on going like that for a long time into the future. It is still here, right? Still available. What a wonderful thing it is that the Dhamma is still available in this present day. Sometimes people say, oh, the Dhamma is not available anymore. Now we have just to wait for Maitreya to come around, and then we will practice. That is delusion, right? Sure, you will practice when Maitreya comes. If you don't want to practice now, then that problem is very likely still to be there when Maitreya comes. You know, oh yeah, Maitreya, not really sure about him. I think I can see some defilements. Yeah, I'm going to be Christian instead or whatever, right? So the only way to prepare yourself for Maitreya is to practice now. Now is the time. Now is the opportunity. It is the Buddha Gautama. We should respect, and we should kind of have a certain deference and practice his teaching, because they're still here and they are still as powerful as ever. So that is enough for now. So I'll meet you half an hour, Bobby. Yeah, half an hour break. So just to have just to get a little bit of break before we do the meditation, and we'll see you back at 4:45. So 35 minutes from now.